With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. And today's episode is smashing. I got to sit down whilst in lockdown over the means of the internet. I sat down with Jamie Reynolds, formerly of the Klaxons and songwriter extraordinaire. We talk about the whole journey. We talk about school. We talk about indie clubs, some bizarre moments that we had in common in our own little journeys. And then obviously we talk about how quickly the Klaxons exploded onto the scene and what an impact they made. And then we discuss all the things that Jamie's been doing as a songwriter since. And it's a smashing chat. It was an absolute delight to sit and talk to. And I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Before we get on with the chat, I just want to say a big thank you to 76 for producing this. Thank you to Scroobius Pittman, everybody over at the Distraction Pieces Network. If this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track and you enjoy it, then I would suggest that you have a look in the back catalogue, because there's about 140 episodes with all your favourite musicians, producers, actors, comedians, creatives, right? So go and have a rummage around in the vaults. And if that's not enough, then I do have a Patreon page, and you can support the podcast over there. There's, if you become a Patreon over there, then you've got access to over 100 episodes never released to the masses over there. I think that's it with the sales pitch thing. I mean, everything you need to know about Off the Beaten Track, you can find out at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. And one last thing, the best thing you can do is just subscribe. If you subscribe, then you have to think about it. Each week, all of a sudden, another cracking little episode of this podcast just turns up on your listening device. All right, that's enough from me. It gives me great pleasure now to say, please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Jamie Reynolds. Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor. Eggfried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Eggfried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Hello, and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. And joining me today is Jamie Reynolds. Hello.
Yeah, hi mate. Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Stu. This is great.
Oh mate, thank you. We've just had a quick chat, and we've both been involved in Boogaloo Radio previously, but we've never met. So it's always quite strange meeting people for the first time via a screen. It's
definitely in the new world. But I mean, you know, the more it's gone on, the more I'm used to it. So all of a sudden, you know, sort of ready for the 21st century.
Well, that's kind of really what I'd like to sort of start with, really. Like, how have you found it, you know, isolation as both a human being and a creative?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm like approaching week 12 or maybe even week 13. I went quite early. I sort of noticed about 2 weeks before lockdown what was going on, and being quite a sort of, I don't know, a person who's really sort of into the media, etc. I sort of noticed it and realised that there was something going on, and at work they were talking about closing down the offices and the record labels, and I just saw it coming. So quite quickly, I sort of put myself at home. So I've been indoors. So I was indoors for quite a bit, and that first like 2 or 3 weeks was quite horrible, to be honest with you. A lot of fear on my part, a lot of reading the media, a lot of fear and worry, basically. And I sort of drove myself to being quite upset about the entire thing. And then I think I got to about week 3, and I made the sensible decision to stop sort of following the media and stop reading Twitter, and because like I'm addicted to Twitter. I'm just like, give me the information, and about week 3, I just decided that wasn't doing me any favours whatsoever, and I stopped reading it. And I think that's the best thing I could have possibly done for myself. And then slowly, as a creative, like, and then at that point, I just sort of like started feeling better, reaching out. I mean, I was talking to a lot of friends and family. I feel very connected at this point in time as well, even though isolation is, you know, I'm on my own at home here with my dog. But I feel very connected to my friends and very connected to my family. And so the phone has helped with that, and that's been excellent. And then in about week 3, I decided, okay, cool, maybe I'm ready to like start working again. And some people reached out to me, and I started helping them with this woman, this great woman called Selena Giles, had written these incredible words, and she asked me to put some music to it. So I started making something for the first time in a while. And that felt really good to sort of kickstart creativity again. And that was really the Kickstarter. And then since like sort of week 4 and 5, I've got to be honest with you, I've been having an awesome time. Like I feel quite, it's a strange thing because I'm very aware of the sort of bigger picture and so incredibly grateful for all the incredible work that people are doing for people in trouble. But on a personal level, I'm actually having an awesome time right now.
That's great.
Yeah, you know, I've been very creative. I've sort of gone back to the studio. I've been doing a lot of work. Very connected to people, out in the sunshine with my dog, and living a very sort of like happy, low key, hardworking but fun lifestyle that I've like really gotten into, to be honest.
I think what you touched on earlier about sort of switching off the news channels and them kind of media feeds, I think that's really important. I think that was exactly what you done is what I done. At first, I was just consuming so much information and so much of it was scaring me, and I was just thinking, oh, you know, then there was a conspiracy theory side of things in me just thinking, no, this can't be. And it was so many mixed messages were coming through, and I think once I realized, well, ultimately there's nothing I can do about this other than sit tight, so I might as well stop watching that and get back to, you know, doing things that are good for my head, which is what we're doing now. Things like this, like creating stuff and just, you know, getting on with business as usual, but just in a different environment. I think so many of us probably had them knee-jerk reactions as soon as it happened, and then you start to adjust and then work out what works for you, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely sounds like the most sort of sensible way to go about it. I just, like, it helped my mental health no end. You know, I was just incredibly sort of sorting the video. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Cool. I just think it's sensible. Like, people like my friends who are very sort of smart people, who are very media digesting people as well, we just, without talking to each other, we all came to the conclusion that for our own mental health, the best thing to do was just sort of, you know, live our best lives for ourselves, you know, not the bigger feel that the bigger picture will sort itself out in time. I felt like I'd had all the information that I needed to digest and to know how I was going to go about my life in this new world. And once I'd come to that conclusion of what that was and how I was going to navigate with all of this going on, then I'd quite sort of happily gone about my business. And it's been the best thing I've ever done for myself, I think. It's just a level of acceptance, you know, and that there's nothing you can do about it. Got to sort of ride the wave, if it were, you know, sort of ride it out. And feels like it was definitely the right decision. And right now, everything's cool. I know it's obviously not the bigger picture, but on a personal level, it's cool.
Wonderful. Well, let's start your playlist. So, Jamie, for track one, I'm going to ask you what the song is with the greatest ever intro.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, what's the greatest ever intro? My answer to this question would probably change on a weekly basis.
Obviously, okay? We all know that.
You know, like the greatest is amazing. They're always like, and we're doing a lot of work recently where like you write something down one week and then you look back at it the next week and you're like, what's I thinking that song? What was going on? So like it changes all the time. But it was a really brilliant question to ask me at a time when I was thinking about the song that I've chosen. I was out on my bike. I've got like a phone holder strapped to the front handlebars and I sort of ride around on my bike, listen to music, and it's a really nice time. And this song, Brother's Gonna Work It Out by Willie Hutch came up. And it's got, I don't know how long it is, but it's got this brilliant spoken word intro. And I just thought to myself that it's absolutely brilliant, the way it sort of sums up the way of thinking about, I don't know, I thought it sort of related to business in a way. It's sort of like quite related to what was going on right now. It's just super enjoyable. And the track is, it's phenomenal. And for today, I'm going to say it's the greatest intro ever.
Wonderful. Well, Jamie, I always ask musicians this question, and it's just to kind of ask regarding intros. When you know, in the early days of the Klaxons, when there was lots of expectation and media attention, how was you approaching writing intros then to how you would write an intro now? And also taking into account the way that people listen to music as well now.
Totally. I think I might be completely wrong about this, but I'm not sure that I've ever written one. someone's like, listen to my back catalogue. You know, there's one there, mate. But I've sort of come from the sort of Bill Drummond KLF way of thinking, from like the How to Have a Number One, the Easy Way book, which I read in the weeks leading up to when we first wrote the Klaxons debut record.
That's an interesting book to read just before you release your first album.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so grateful. I got a mention in the Chaos book, the yellow one that came out recently.
Wow.
I was mentioned as the person that put the theory into practice. And I didn't have a number one, which is really annoying, but I did have number two. So it works. And that thinking is sort of what he would call the golden rules. And actually, it's not true to say that there isn't an intro, because the intro with that in mind is sometimes you take the chorus and you make the melody of the chorus instrumentally before the first verse comes in.
Yeah.
So an intro for me is always just sort of like short, sharp, when I think of the word intro, like it makes me think, I mean, the Billy Hutch tune, for example, like, goes on for sort of a minute and a half.
Yeah.
But for me, an intro at its most, because I'm thinking like pop structures.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, like, yeah.
I would consider that only an intro would either be like a couple of bars, and it's getting shorter and shorter these days as well. So like, whereas in the past I would maybe do like a full chorus and make it melodic with the same melody as that was coming in the chorus. Nowadays, it's like I would make it even shorter and songs... I mean, I've written a lot of songs in that sort of 2:40 bracket anyway, but then I got used to the sort of 3:30 bracket. But now things are shorter. So intros, for me, are just becoming very quick. And sometimes you wouldn't even worry about it. You just chuck the chorus right in the front of the song.
Is radio a consideration?
Yeah, radio drove me absolutely mental. I think that like thinking about radio has been the thing that has played on my mind and driven me the most mad for a very long time. I obsessed, especially when radio sort of picked up Klaxons, you know, and yeah, we were sure. Getting that tension and we were thinking that, I mean, we already had the first batch and we could see what was going to happen with the first record. But then when it came to making a second record, and still now, like, because I work as a songwriter now, so I help other people write songs. And I know that I work with a lot of younger people. I mean, the main artist that I work with is absolutely brilliant. His name's Daniel Briskin, and he's 18 years old. And he is not thinking about the radio for a second. But my brain is so sort of, because I've grown up in that environment, that I just fully, I need to train myself not to think about it, yeah. Right? To get away from radio, because in my head, radio is the be all and end all. That moment of having worked on something and then having it played on the radio, knowing that it's being transmitted to so many people simultaneously, is the thing that is like the driving factor in what I do, you yeah. know? And it's that magical moment that yeah. you get when you write songs. So, the answer is that yes, it's a like overwhelming consideration, but I would really like to wean myself off of it.
Yeah. Okay. Track two, the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Yeah, thank you. That's a brilliant question. And again, I would not. Okay, so here we go. Like, I would not have been able to answer this question had it not been for lockdown. And that's because this the first song I remember having an emotional impact on me, I've been searching for, I'd say pretty much my entire life since I first heard this song. And I have not been able to find it. And I worked in record shops for years. I'm around songwriters and musicians like all the time. And I ask anybody whether or not they have heard what this song is, and nobody has had the answer for me. And then during lockdown in week, I don't know, whatever it was, I had the bright idea just to Google it and try and find out what it was. And this song was, I think I must have been sort of 4 years old, or maybe it's around three or four. And my mum had bought me a copy of Paul McCartney's Rupert and the Frog Chorus VHS. And so he'd watched like the Rupert Bear video film. He goes down to the cave and hangs up with the frogs and we all stand together and blah, blah, blah. That kind of like, you know, what people consider like an intercepted like, pop song. But then after that finished, there were two songs that came on. Both had videos. And they haunted me for a very long time trying to find out what those two videos were, because my earliest memories of watching Rupert and the Frog Chorus and then these two songs coming on afterwards, and I've been trying to find out what they were forever. Anyway, yeah, I Googled it a couple of weeks ago, and I've been listening to these two songs pretty much like most days since. And the one that had the emotional like impact on me is because it was so damn weird. With Linda McCartney, Oriental Nightfish. And it had a sort of psychedelic video that I'm not sure that is going to warp a four-year-old's mind. And that was what I first remember seeing as being like music and thinking was really, you know, it must have, I mean, it's weird because I look at it now and I still feel that I write music to fit what in what could be that video. I highly recommend watching the video. It's about as out there as it gets. And, yeah, it's written by Paul and Linda. And, yeah, the Oriental Nightfish, it's mind-blowing. And I remember it making me feel very weird then, feel very weird now, and it's just awesome.
So what emotion would that have been, Jamie?
It's just, like, oddness.
Yeah.
I just remember, like, having this feeling of, like, strangeness. Like, you know, like, wow, what is this stuff called music?
Yeah.
You know, and, like, oh, here is this. It's just, you know, I think that, you know, the Frog Chorus had brought me joy, but that wasn't the impact. The impact was all what I'm discovering something weird here.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of weirdness has been a thread throughout everything I've ever done since.
So where was home then, Jamie? Where was you born?
I grew up in Dorset, not too far away from Bournemouth. And yeah, it's a little seaside town there in a place called Christchurch. And yeah, it's a pleasant place. And the clock in town says where time is pleasant, and it's a nice little town just outside of Bournemouth, on the beach there.
And so, aside from your Frog Chorus VHS, was there much music on at home growing up?
Yeah, because my parents were publicans and they ran the pub in the centre of Bournemouth. And it's called Criterion. And it was a very busy, open pub in the middle of town. And there were a lot of people sort of coming and going. There's lots to sort of say about that pub and its history. It's sadly, it's not there anymore. they've turned it into the Top Man. But if you go to Bournemouth and you're in town and there's now the Top Man there, that used to be a pub called the Criterion that my parents ran.
So did you live there as well?
Yeah, I did. I lived there until I was like two. Yeah. And then from two, I moved over to this small town, a bit out of there. Sadly, my parents broke up when I was very young at two. And I went with my mother over to this place called Christchurch. And my dad stayed at the Criterion, which closed in 1986, I think. So music was continuously being played in the pub. And sort of whatever was going on in sort of 1982 was, it was being played in the background. So I've had a sort of always having music on in the background. And then, it was quieter over in Christchurch. But that there always being something on in the background, whether it being played by my family or being introduced to it by friends at a very young age. It's always been a sort of, music's always been there in the background.
Okay. So for question three, I'm going to ask you the song that reminds you of your time at school. Was school in Christchurch?
Yeah, I went to a place called Highcliffe School. And Highcliffe is like on the border of Dorset and Hampshire. It's like just as you get into Hampshire. I've been going over this recently, looking at, I've had quite a reflective lockdown as well.
Sure.
And I've been going over the music of my life. So it's quite, I'm so grateful that you asked me these questions and popped up at that time where I feel ready that I was like almost ready to answer them because I might have been a bit stuck. Sure. But school, it's funny where to put it because there was so much music at school as well. And I can remember music being a big part of my life from around about 1986, like where I was like 1986 and onwards, where like I was wanting to have a copy of or being able to listen to that music in my own time, right from sort of New Kids on the Block, basically. Michael Jackson, New Kids on the Block. Beats International, I remember being a big part of my growing up. But when I think of school, like that was the sort of what you call junior school time. But when I think of school, it's really kind of secondary school. And that's where things started to get really exciting because I started secondary school in 1991. And that would be when I think about being at school. And that time was just mind blowing because between sort of the whole period was such an exciting time for music. In 1991, in first year of school, the thing that I remember being really excited about, I mean, I'm just going to name loads of records, but it's not the one I've chosen. I'll tell you the one I've chosen after. But
you're more than welcome to some honourable mentions, mate.
Yeah, some honourable mentions are big. The honourable mention will go out to The Prodigy for The Prodigy Experience, which was like the big one that we all sort of... We used to basically go into Bournemouth on the bus and somebody... If you chipped in some money each, you could buy like a deck of cassettes where like you'd have 10 cassettes or 20 cassettes or however many it was. One person would buy one album and then you'd all buy a cassette. So if someone bought one, you'd take it over, copy it, and then you'd all get a copy of it. And
what a genius idea. Why did me and my mates never do that? That's such a sensible thing to do, isn't it?
that was what we did. Yeah, it was like, so you could have... One person would buy something, then you'd all have blank cassettes, and then you'd split it, and you'd have a copy of a copy of a copy. Mm. And the sound quality would be awful, but you'd have a copy of it, and then you'd have your Walkman. So, school basically existed. You'd be having fun with your mates or whatever. And I was a studious kid. Like, I did okay at school. At the same time, my Walkman was on the whole time. And on the Walkman, you'd have two sides of a cassette, 90 minutes, 45 minutes each. And I think my favourite one would have sort of The Prodigy Experience on one side, and on the flip side, it would have Nirvana, Nevermind. But neither of those, they're just the honourable mentions, because the thing from school, really, and I sort of throw myself under the bus a bit, like, we were pretty naughty at school, I grew up, Highcliffe as well, the place where I grew up, it's on a beach, and it was a surfing town, really. And our thing at school was, like, after school, we'd all go surfing. And we were sort of, we were into smoking hash at a really young age, and like having a cool time. We'd surf and smoke hash and listen to tunes on the Walkman. And the song that I've chosen that really reminds me of school for that exact reason was from Rat Pack, and it's called Searching for My Rizzler. And that was the banger that I was like, oh yeah, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs, because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guests pick.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. The stuff that was going on in 91, it's, I mean, they were possibly like the first years that as a club DJ in sort of alternative clubs, like it really exploded. You know, we'd had a touch of it in 89 with what was happening in sort of Manchester, but that early 90s, and it was so interesting to be in alternative clubs as well, and playing, I guess, the English stuff, which would have been Wonder Stuff, Carter, Senseless Things, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then also what was coming over from the States at that point, which would, you know, was the huge kind of wave of MTV, and I loathe to call it grunge, but
yeah, exactly.
But Smashing Pumpkins, Nirvana, and Pearl Jam, Jane's Addiction, etc. And to be playing all of that in a club, yet still playing Rat Pack, Outer Space, SL2, you know,
yeah, exactly.
And it was, I think it was a really good point for music crossing over. And
where was your club?
It's in Essex. It's called the Pink Toothbrush. It's
amazing. Is it still going?
Yeah, I should have been there this evening. I've been there for 28 years. It's
that's so cool. That's exactly my experience of growing up as well. In Bournemouth, there were I grew, like when I started going clubbing at quite a young age. So I'm just trying to like plug my phone in and speak to you at the same time. I started going clubbing at quite a young age. In 1994 was when I started, and there was a place in Bournemouth called the Hot House. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was where I was going there from 1994. And it was that, on the Hot House would be on Thursdays and Saturdays. And then on Fridays, we'd go to the Joiner's Arms in Southampton. And going out to like alternative clubs was like how I grew up. That's what we did from 1994 until I moved to London in 1998. And yeah, absolutely. It was that melting pot of there being really exciting UK American plus being able to like drop in the dance tracks at the time as well. That made what, I mean, I call it indie disco, but I go back indie disco is maybe a little bit later, but that environment of like there being an alternative music club was just like, that's where I grew up. And it was like the most exciting place in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I did go to a few places in Bournemouth. There was, if I remember right, there was a place called the Old Fire Station.
Yeah, the Old Fire Station's good. I mean, like that was like a little bit after my time.
And one place called Mr. Smith's.
Mr. Smith's was like the first place that I ever went to a gig. Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you, mate. That's so nice you remember that. And then I remember going back there in the years to come. Like, when I was in a band when I was a kid, like, we just wanted to play Mr. Smith. So that was like my motivation. I don't remember we played it, actually. We ended up being like the in-house band over at the Joiners but in Southampton. But it was a really healthy place for music at that time. Mr. Smith's... so amazing. Nobody's mentioned that place to me for a long time.
I played it. It was the only place I ever played in Bournemouth. Like, my band played at Mr. Smith's.
That's the coolest place. That's where everybody wanted to be. That's amazing. I'm going to mention that to my friends later, and that's going to blow their minds. And then a bit later, there was a place called The Extreme. I don't know if you ever went there.
I don't remember that.
On Holdenhurst Road. So when the Hot House closed down, then a place called Extreme opened. There was a DJ there called Keith. I don't know if you ever met that guy.
Possibly.
And there was a DJ called DJ Hammy, who was the guy that was like we all followed. And because he played at the Hot House on a... Was he the guy there? I can't remember if he was the guy there on a Thursday or not, but we would follow Hammy because he was in Bournemouth, but then he would DJ in Southampton. And so we then followed him to Southampton. And there was a club in Southampton called Thursdays that was on a Wednesday. And... we would religiously go there as well. And it was just such an exciting time. It's like, thinking about those are the best times, like 1994 to 1997, between those clubs in Southampton and Bournemouth.
And I guess that was the kind of the Britpop explosion around then as well, wasn't it? I guess years was, you know, and I guess the Prodigy went from being just a dance band to bringing the rave to the rock festivals at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I had fully given myself in because I was like into the rave. So it's like 1991 to 93 to 94. Up to 94, I was very into like the grunge and the UK rave thing. And then as soon as this is what blew my mind, like the other day when I was looking back at it, is that In Utero and Girls and Boys by Blur came out within months of each other.
How fucking mental is that?
I don't have words. Like it. The idea, because they seem so worlds apart, and even in my life, like even my experience of it, and I guess it goes to show how like quickly you change as a kid. But one minute, like In Utero was like my absolute everything, and the next minute, Blur dropped Girls and Boys, and then my life completely changed. And that from that moment on, I was like Britpop the entire way. Like that, I was sold on the whole thing. And then it was a very exciting 3 years for me. Yeah.
The day I cut my long hair off was the day I bought my first Fred Perry.
Exactly. But there's a photograph I could show you that like I had curtains, you know, like the long hair, like either side. And then one day I'd gone over to my friend's house. I think Supergrass had released Caught by the Fuzz. And my friend was like, "Here you go, mate. Here's the scissors." And I cut my fringe. And from the moment I cut my fringe, it was game on.
So did you enjoy school?
Yeah, school was fun, but school was really good fun. I mean, my friends at school were great. We'd go surfing together, and we had a good gang of friends, and some of which I still speak to this day. And I go home, and I still see people. And school was really cool. I mean, I feel very lucky to have grown up in a place that was nice, and we went surfing, and we had freedom, and we were naughty, and like it was fun. And school I enjoyed. I was like fairly academic. I did okay at school. I was good at maths and I got grades and I enjoyed it.
What did you want to be?
Say again, sorry.
What did you want to be at school?
I've just always wanted to be a musician. I mean, I remember, it just clicked. I just always wanted to sort of be in a group. I did my work experience in a record shop. I was just completely sold on music. Like that was it. I knew what I wanted to do. There was no other way. I remember thinking that I was going, I can't remember. I remember thinking that I wanted to do something else for a moment, but no, I was very sold on music from a young age. I was in my first band while I was at school, at 14. So I knew that that was what I wanted to make a success of, you know, we did pretty well. My band was called Thermal, and we were like the in-house band at Southampton Joiners, and all the bands that came through at that time we supported. We ended up playing with Manson, Heavy Stereo, this band Fluffy. I'm trying to think of.
I supported Fluffy.
No, you didn't.
Yeah. I supported Fluffy at the Y Club in Chelmsford. And I'll tell you what, the night I supported Fluffy, the bass player that's no longer in Blondie, that was the one that's on Parallel Lines, the guy with the big curly hair, he flew over from America to watch Fluffy. And so we was at this tiny little venue and we were supporting Fluffy, who we'd kind of heard about, because they were all like, really pretty girls, weren't they?
Yeah, they were like hot girls in a punk band.
Yeah, and so we was like super excited to be supporting them, like to be supporting them. And then literally someone went, the dude from Blondie's in the crowd. And so it was like a really like memorable night for me.
That is so crazy that we both shared that experience. That they came to Southampton to join us, and it was like a big, it was like everything that came through there was like, you know, I saw all the indie bands that came through there between 1994 to 1997, and it was such an exciting time. But that night, you know, we got that gig. It was just like, this is going to be amazing. These like hot punk girls, and that's brilliant, man. And we both had that same feeling.
Okay. For track four, Jamie, the first song you remember buying from a record shop.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a toss up in my mind which record to go for. And I would often say, because I remember going on my roller skates to the garage to buy a copy of Michael Jackson's Bad or cassette. But that would be, because it was from the garage, I prefer your question what was from the record shop, and I'll answer that one instead. It wasn't exactly a record shop, but there was a John Menzies in the centre of Christchurch. Yeah. And I went to the John Menzies and I bought a copy of the Stock Aitken and Waterman produced Reynolds Girls single, because we shared the name, I'd Rather Jack. And I'd seen it on TV like the week before. And there was something out with my name in it. And some like cool girls from Liverpool. And I was like, yeah, got to have that. That's awesome.
I mean, you've won. You've completed it, mate. I mean, up until now, I love it when musicians come on and are honest. And just don't try and be caught at this point. And so far, the winner was Russell Lissack with Stiltskin. You've surpassed it, mate. The Reynolds Girls, incredible, mate.
Get on that. It's the coolest record. I think I've got three copies of it. Like, honestly, like, I don't think being cool like is important at all. Like, all I want to do is be honest about everything. Like, there's no point. And honestly, and I still love the record. Like, it's Stock Aitken and Waterman, you know, who I fell in love with, and I think that it was them that sort of got me into the whole making pop music. And, two girls from Liverpool dressed in denim, dancing around, you know, who were like, you know, jacking was like a cool thing to be doing, but they diluted it so much for kids.
Yeah.
I was like, this is amazing.
Oh, two things regarding that. I love watching retro Top of the Pops on a Friday night on BBC 3 or 4, and they're currently around 88 at the moment, and the Reynolds Girls were on there jacking live. I mean, it weren't good, mate. It really weren't.
Was it wasn't good.
It was fucking terrible. But I think that was the if you watch anything about Stock Aitken and Waterman, they say like that was the kind of turning point where they had the formula. They were, and I mean this, They were Motown, you know. If you strip it down to their structures of pop songs, yes, some of the sounds have dated terribly, but they wrote some... The songwriting was amazing pop songs, and they said at that point they thought they had the formula sussed, and they're like, we can make anyone a pop star. So they sort of exhausted all the pop stars, and they tested the water with Sonya that they could kind of get someone and just make them a pop star, and they're like, right, let's go and try and find... you know, someone off the street and just make it happen. And that was the Reynolds Girls. And they said people kind of saw through it and was like, right, hang on a minute. Are they trying to pull the wool over our eyes here? What's going on? And they said that was like literally the turning point for Stock Aitken and Waterman.
I love it. That's my like introduction to music. It sort of all makes sense. I was very lucky to sit down with Rick Astley recently.
How was that?
He sort of like gave me, we were both at a wedding together, and someone had really nicely sat me opposite him at the wedding. So I felt like I got this, I was like nervous at first, sort of asking questions about music, but I could tell that someone put me there because they thought that we would get on with each other.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky to get sort of the ins and outs of the story, his experience, what he went through. And I got a sort of, you know, an afternoon's worth of mentoring from him. It was absolutely amazing.
How incredible. Because he was famously the tea boy, wasn't he? Exactly.
He was the tea boy. And it was that thought when you're saying that they decided to bring anybody through, like he wasn't going to be the pop star, he was the tea boy. And yeah, and they brought him through and in his career. Like, yeah, it was incredible to be able to get that time with him. And I became friends with him over there, like not long before this lockdown. So very,
superb.
Very happy. I'm not afraid to say I love Stock Aitken and Waterman.
Oh, they've got some cracking pop songs there, mate. Some cracking pop songs. Most guests have said they bought their first tracks from either Menzies or Woolworths or Boots at the time when Boots used to sell records. But in regards to sort of record shops in maybe sort of a little bit later in life, like how important were they for you?
Yeah, I mean, record shops have been my life, really. There was an independent record shop in Christchurch called Trax, and it's no longer there, but that was the place that I would go into on a weekend to go to check out what was going on. I made sure that I became friendly with the person that worked there because I wanted to sort of be able to talk to him about what he thought was cool and what, just know what was coming out and, just say hi, basically. And I was young when I went in there. And then I'm trying to figure this out exactly when it was, because my friends in my band don't remember me working there. And then my friend from school doesn't remember what year it was that we did work experience. But it must have been about 1993. And then I was really lucky to they accepted me to do my work experience there when I was younger. So I did that and got my first taste of, the records come in, you unpack them, you put the CD in the wallet or the cassette, you take it out so it's not on display, and then looking at everything, alphabetizing it, putting it into the category that it's got to go in, and then go and put it out on the shelves and like helping people discover what it is they're looking for, and like being on the shop floor in a record shop from being like 13. So I'm very lucky with that. Which one came first? Yeah. And then so I'd had that experience working there. And then after uni, when I got sort of halfway through uni and didn't finish and then came back to Bournemouth, they'd opened up a Borders Books and Music. I don't know if you remember that company.
Yeah.
In Bournemouth. And then I went there, so they're advertising jobs, looking for people to work there. And then I went along and it turned out it was the guy that I'd worked with in Tracks as my work experience who was selecting people to work for the job in Bournemouth. So he gave me the job working at Borders Books and Music. And I worked in there doing the classical music section, and everyone helped with rock and pop, but I did classical. And that was a brilliant, brilliant time. Before that, the record shop that was so important to us was a place called Snoopy's in a place called Boscombe near Bournemouth. And it was a secondhand place, and they would buy, sell, and exchange. And as well as like working, I used to work as a dishwasher in a restaurant in town. And as well as the money that we'd get from that, we'd buy records from there and sell records from there and be extra money for beers for us on the weekends. So we'd go in there and get like secondhand records. So like Tracks or HMV or wherever we go to in town would be the place we get new music. But then to buy older stuff on vinyl, we'd go to this place called Snoopy's, and that was our like mecca. But that was where we'd go. And then there are quite a lot of record shops in Bournemouth, but Tracks and then Borders. And I worked at Borders for a couple of years. And then after Borders, I moved to Southampton and I got a job working for an independent record shop, which sadly is no longer with us. It was called Essential Music. They have one in Greenwich. I don't know if you ever went to that one in Greenwich, but they have one in Brighton, one in Bournemouth, one in Southampton, one in Glasgow, I think. And it was a company run by a guy called Neil Williams. And that was really my musical education from 21 to 24, where he gave me a job in there. And it was the kind of record shop where you could smoke in there, and we were arseholes, we would just hang out in there and be rude to people all day. Have like Neil had like the best music taste and had filled the shop with like incredible records, and we had access to that all day long. And we'd be standing there, making sure the record shop ran right and doing good business, but being like arrogant pricks, the whole
pure time. High fidelity.
It was, I hate to say it, but it was that thing. Like there were moments where like people would bring over like a Chris Rea record or whatever, and you'd pick it up like by the corner, like making sure that
you didn't like it,
and then, like, giving it back to them, and, like, taking their tenner and being like, "Yeah, all right, mate, if you want to buy that, it's like you, mate." It was really bad. I feel really bad about how you behaved at that time.
Oh, that's shocking. But I would really so bad. Have done the same.
It was really bad, but, like, you know, my mate would give a shout to Kevin, who was, like, the manager. And Neil was the owner, and he was the guy that was giving us all the education by stocking the shop and, like, lending us books and just, like, being so incredibly on it. But then Kevin had the attitude. He's from Falkirk and works in the shop in Glasgow. And his attitude was just full-on punk in the shop, you know. And yeah, we were sort of mentored by him. And it was like, yeah, be an arsehole, have a great time. And he was like, okay, great. So, yeah, I mean, the record shop was that was home, you know. And I worked in there from 2001. And then at the end of it, I moved to London. And then I got transferred. Actually, no, before then, I worked in Music and Video Exchange in London as well. The first time I moved to London, I worked in Music and Video Exchange for a while. The record shop that you'll find all over London. And I worked in the one in Notting Hill, and you had to do the test to get into that.
What's the test?
So the test is really bad. It's like High Fidelity Plus. Like they ask you like hundreds of questions. It's like how many people aren't called Brian in Roxy Music or whatever. It's just like it's really like in-depth music nerd, like really putting you on the spot. And you go into the shop, and I remember. And then they're like, okay, mate, you have to go and sit upstairs in a quiet room upstairs, and they give you a piece of paper and you have to answer however many questions it is. I think it's like 100 questions or whatever it is, or music. And yeah, to pass that, you have to pass the test before getting the job at Music and Video Exchange. And thankfully I passed that. I did pretty well, and they gave me the job. And I worked in the one in Notting Hill for a while. And then I worked in the one in Greenwich. Then I switched to the one in Greenwich, and then all of a sudden I got the transfer because I really wanted to work back at Essential Music because I'd worked in the one in Southampton and had enjoyed that so much, and my friends worked there, so I wanted to go back, and they gave me the job back. I went back to Essential Music, being rude and smoking and getting on everybody's nerves for a long time, and then sadly they made me redundant, and I took that money, and then I built the studio, and then Clancers happened a couple of months later.
I was going to say, this must have been around the time that the band was starting to sort of come into fruition.
Yeah, like, so I'd like been having my education and collecting my vinyl collection, my record, my CDs and everything that I sort of grown up with, and making that, my collection grow. And then that was like the end of my education. I was like, okay, cool. Well, I've been made redundant. What do I do now? I miss being in a band from when I was a kid. All right, it's time to make a band. And it was like months out of the record shop that I then formed Clancers. And
so did that happen quite quickly, Jamie?
It was super quick. So basically I had taken the money that I'd been given with the redundancy, and I'd become really good friends with a guy called Joe Daniel, who ran a record company called Angular Records. And they were Joe. I'd read about Joe in the NME, and I was like, yeah, this is the guy that I need to be friends with. He put out what was it called? I wish I could remember. I'm sorry, Jar. I can't remember the name of your first compilation. But basically, it was music from Deptford, and the cool Sid Block Party were on it, Art Brute were on it, and cool music that was coming out of New Cross and Deptford at the time, which is where just around the corner from Greenwich and where we hung out, and there was cool stuff going on. And Joe and I had become really good friends. And then he and I, straight with my redundancy money, built a rehearsal space together. There was a block where you could take over the building and put offices or whatever you wanted in there, and we decorated it and turned it into a rehearsal space. And once that space was up and running, I'd already met some of the Claxons guys over that summer, and then Simon. And then Simon, he'd moved to London, and then as soon as he moved to London, it was game on, and Claxons happened in like 5 days. We'd had the plan, we knew what it was going to be, and then as soon as we had the space and the time to do it, we just got on with it and did it very, very quickly.
And so did you get signed quite quickly?
Our first record came out on Joe's record label. So, you know, Joe was already putting out records by Block Party, Art Brute, and a handful of other, maybe some of the most recognisable, but a handful of other people. And we formed on the 5th of November, which was like bonfire night, because I'd been to a party, and then I came back to the studio and started making music on that night. And that was in November. And by the time it came to the break for Christmas, and it was all so crazy, like by the time it came to break for Christmas, we'd played a show at the 333 in Hoxton, and there'd been people that had come down there from the media, and they knew that by the time January was going to come around, that there'd be a lot of interest in us. And Joe put out our first single in March, for the following year, which is already recorded. I can't remember if we recorded that before Christmas or not, but it was very quick. It just went. It was instantaneous, pretty much. We wrote the songs. The singles were written in the first 5 days, and then it was just getting into studio, recording it, and getting out there and doing a handful of shows. Give a shout out to a guy called Kevin at the time, who ran a thing called Greenwich Pirate. And there were just parties already going on. There were like somewhere to play, you know. And there were nights that we could go and play at. The night that we did at Hobson that I mentioned was run by the Queens of Noise. I don't know if you remember those guys. And everybody was like super, super connected. You know, it felt like there was a connection to already jump into. There was a club scene. And there were people that were putting on club nights all the time that we just, it was already there for us to jump into. And we did it and everybody sort of liked it. So it worked very quickly.
Well, that leads on perfectly to track 5, which is the song that soundtracked your years in Clubland, Jamie.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, yeah, it kind of does. But then I think about Clubland and I think about before that, because, yeah, it was Clubland, but I felt like my kind of second time round at 25.
Yeah.
When I think about clubbing, the first time round was when I was 14 to 17 in Bournemouth and Southampton. But really, if I think about clubbing, then it was probably like when I was 18 and I was at university and I probably spent more time thinking about how to get into a club or which club to go to rather than actually studying philosophy, which is what
Where was that?
I went to Greenwich University and I was based in Woolwich. And, it's not the nicest place in the world. And it was like I had a lot of fun. It was cool and I loved the course. And I did I was doing okay on the course, and I enjoyed it. But really, I was more interested in doing ecstasy and going out to clubs. And that was like, yeah, I wanted to go to, when I think of clubbing, like I wanted to go to Turnmills, basically, and get involved in the whole Big Beat thing that was going on in Brighton and things that were going on in London with like John Carter and the Chemical Brothers. And that was the most exciting thing to me when I think about clubbing.
What would that have been? Like the social and stuff like that?
Yeah, the social I loved, yeah. And Turnmills was the one really that I had the best nights.
Yeah.
And that period in time. And I guess the reason that I've chosen this track was because I wish I could remember the name of the club night. But they did it was all like Skint Records and that kind of thing. And I was like really into the whole like Big Beat thing. And there was a night put on at the Scala. And I remember going to the Scala on this Big Beat night. And I'd gone on my own because I was so into it. Like, I just didn't care. All I wanted to do was, get high and listen to the music. And, it wasn't important. Like, it was a social thing for me. I was quite happy to, go on my own. And one night I'd seen this guy called DJ Punk Rock, who I looked up recently. And it's sad to see that he died recently, not respect for that guy, and I was sad to find that out. And he had this one track called My Beatbox, and I remember hearing it in the Scala during the Big Beat explosion. I was just like, yeah, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard in my life. And that's the one I've chosen.
So are you a dancer, Jamie?
In my head, I think I think I can dance like Norman Soul, but oh my God, no, I'm quite like a bulky guy, you know? And in my head, I'm great, but absolutely not. I mean, I don't think I've even danced for quite a long time, but in my head I'm really good.
Yeah. Would you let yourself go though when you was dancing?
Yeah, definitely. Like back in the day, I was watching people. I remember watching the first thing I remember coming to London and going to the Wag Club. You remember that place?
Of course.
Yeah, the Wag Club. And I'd go there and there was this one guy, a mod guy.
Oh my God. There. He'd be upstairs and he would dance in the middle of the dance floor on his own, doing the best Northern Soul dancing.
Yeah.
That's so bizarre you've just said that. Like, he must have worked there or something, because every time I went to the Wag, I would stand and watch this guy.
That's my experience, mate. We've had we have quite a lot of shared experience. So that mod guy, who, if to trigger your memory, I remember him being in the video for Dancing in the Moonlight by Top Loader.
Was that him?
That's the guy, right? Watch that again, and that is the guy.
Because he was a sharp-looking dude, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's like a mod guy.
Yeah.
And he would do the Northern Soul, and then he'd do, a Cossack-type thing as well. And I just remember that guy being like the coolest guy in London and thinking, okay, wow, how am I going to get to that level? Like, yeah. That guy's absolutely amazing. And and
so in your head, that's what you look like when you dance.
Exactly, yeah. So but nowhere near it. And yeah, in my head, like, I could dance Northern Soul, but no, I mean, you know, I don't think I've got the right shoes for it these days.
Okay. For track six, a favourite song from an artist from your home county.
Yeah, thank you. Giving a lot of shout out to people from it's a funny one from my home county, because Dorset, there are not many bands that sort of came from there, I don't think. But there were a lot of cool groups when I grew up. We used to rehearse above a pub called the Thomas Tripp in Christchurch, and there was a band, a metal band, I guess. They were called Bang Yang. And they were awesome. I remember watching them very, very young and them being great. But the influential bands, there aren't that many sort of names that came out of Dorset. But during the time that I would go clubbing in that period back then, a lot of the people that would also go clubbing then ended up moving to London and making groups. So from that clubbing time when I was younger, I think it was called The Villa then, or the hothouse turned into a place called The Villa, but other people that would go there were Matt Tong from Block Party, Eddie Argos from Art Brew, Nadia Kasaiba, who is a DJ and puts out records on Fantasy with Errol Alkan and those guys, and Daniel Avery, who's like a techno guy also, yeah, on Fantasy. So we all grew up together in that part of town.
That's a pretty solid gang right there.
It's not bad, right? Yeah, so that's us. Like that, we all used to go clubbing together as kids, and we all moved to London. So, you know, those guys we were all sort of part of a scene. It was quite a bigger scene in Bournemouth, where we were close friends, but there were lots of us in different sort of smaller groups. But we were all friends from that period, and then everybody had moved to London and done their things, but they'd made their bands in London, you know. So it's not as if there were bands from Bournemouth that I can shout out and say that they were what were happening then, but they all moved to London and we did our thing in London. So it's quite inspirational. We'd all had a youth and then, you know, moved to London and to follow our musical dreams. So the one I've chosen really is Art Brew, who were kind of a New Cross band in the same way that Claxons were. But Eddie's from Bournemouth, so he gets the shout out. And in their song, Formed a Band, it's my favourite one.
It's a fucking incredible record, that.
Yeah, it's a really cool record, isn't it? Yeah.
I've been trying to get Eddie on. We was chatting because Art Brute were just about to go back out on tour supporting the Subways just before lockdown. I just had Billy from the Subways on, and I was saying, I'd love to get Eddie on. And so I was chatting to him, and he was like, yeah, because he lives in Berlin, I believe, doesn't he?
I know that he did a while back. I mean, I haven't spoken to Eddie, and I were very good friends when we were younger, but I haven't spoken to him for a long time. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. But yeah, I heard he did. Yeah,
so it was all looking like I was going to get him on, and then obviously this has happened. So I'll hit him up and see if he wants to do it over Zoom. But that track, what an amazing record.
Yeah, and it was influential in the sense that anybody could do it, you know. And it had come out before Claxons had started. It was like, okay. And Joe, who I mentioned that ran Angular Records and I shared the studio with, I don't think he put out that record, but Art Brute were they were sort of one of the bigger groups on that label. And so, you know, knowing Eddie from growing up back home and then him being really influential in London. And also, I might as well give him a mention for this as well. The time that I broke my leg in Claxons and I couldn't do the shows was because we played a show with Art Brute in France. And I'd watched Eddie was on before us, and I'd watched Eddie climb up a pole. And then he decided that he didn't want to do it, and he climbed back down. And in my head, and I'd never done anything like on stage before, because I play keys and I play bass guitar and I stand in the middle and sing, so I don't get a chance for like any like on stage antics. But I'd seen him do that, and I thought, okay, cool, well, I'm going to give it a shot. And it was that day that I jumped off the front of the stage and I broke my leg, and that was what had happened with us, and I had to take the time out, and that was because of Eddie as well. So, you know, he's been a big, he was there through my musical journey. He gets the big honourable mention from coming from Bournemouth.
And for someone that was, you know, as been a DJ playing, you know, in indie records, for want of a better description, for the last God knows how many years. You know, obviously I played Klaxon's records, and for someone that's, you know, interested in you know, movements in music and you know, constantly looking for new and exciting bands, it felt that things happened. You used to become very, very, you're on the front cover of a lot of magazines, and you were on TV. It seemed like it all happened quite quickly. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the period that from forming on November the 5th, 2016, to playing the Brit Awards with Rihanna in February 2008, that's 16 months.
Yeah, that's crackers. So what I want to ask is, how did you cope with that as a person? Was you always, you know, was you confident? Was you a show off? Did you like attention? And how becoming a famous indie band, like how was that for you?
It was absolutely brilliant. I realized my dreams. You know, I felt like I'd been preparing for a long time, yeah, from like being younger and growing up where I'd had, having been in bands before growing up in, and having some sense of what that could be like, and that being my dream. You know, it was always my dream to be in that situation. So I felt like I'd been in training for it for a very, yeah, long time. And then when it happened, I felt ready to go and ready to for everything that it was going to be able to provide for us. And I don't know. I would throw myself under the bus a little bit. Like, I really went for it. I mean, I was out of my mind for quite a long time. Sure. I'm sober these days. But at that time, we were getting really high and being crazy. And the crazier we were, the more people loved it. And we just rode that wave with happiness. You know, we were just like having the best possible time. I felt like it was my job to have the best possible time to show anybody that if they wanted to be in a band and they wanted to have the best possible time, they could do it. And so that was how I felt every day when I woke up. I was just like, I need to show people that this is the most fun you can possibly have, and look at us doing it. And yes, you can go and do it yourself. So, yeah, I mean, I felt ready. I was up for it. And I was just like having the best time ever. Really, yeah.
Wow, what a wonderful answer.
Yeah, thank you.
Last track, Jamie, you get to play DJ now, and I'm going to ask you to pick a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
That's a good question. Why am I going to have to, like, so we're on the Zoom, right? You're on my phone, and it means that I can't look at my phone to tell you, because I'm going to get the name of this band wrong.
I've got it on my phone here, so we can...
And it's like I was saying before, you know, like, if you answer me that question... today, I'd probably give you a different answer to the one that, yeah, I sent you a couple of days ago.
Okay.
So can I ask you a favour? And that's what it is.
You went for Going to Make a Time Machine by, yeah, Majestic Arrows.
Okay, Majestic Arrows. Good. That's good. Yeah. So I'd heard it on the day that you asked me, and I was just like, yeah, this is the coolest thing that I've heard recently. And it's kind of got that soul feel, which I've been really into during lockdown, because it's like the happiest music.
It's joyous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just so, like, I've really craved that. Like, music has been really, the first 3 weeks of lockdown, I couldn't listen to music at all. And then as soon as I got to the point where I was like, yeah, okay, I'm ready to listen to music again, all of a sudden, like, loads of really cool stuff started coming to me that I'd never heard before. And I hadn't heard the song that I've chosen before up until a couple of days ago. And it's just my favourite of some of the sort of soul music I've been listening to lately that's really kind of helped me through lockdown. So I guess for that reason, I wanted to share it with other people.
So you've gone for Majestic Arrows, which you said you heard on the day. And so what I want to ask you is, are you one of those people that when you discover a new record and you like it, do you listen to it over and over and over again?
Yeah, if I really fall in love with something, I'll hammer it until I can't stand it anymore, and then go back to it a little while later.
Do you deconstruct it? Do you deconstruct it as a musician? Do you deconstruct it and work out, you know, the you know, how it's put together, and do you draw from things?
Disease. Like that? Yeah, I think I've got a disease. Like, I can't listen to anything without knowing how it was made, what the instruments are,
yeah,
what the structural changes of the song are, how it's worked. And I'm always looking for something like a way a song has worked that I've never heard a song work before, and then I want to steal a little idea of how things were done. I mean, yeah, it's a massive problem in the same way that it is me listening to songs and thinking about the radio, of yeah. me listening to music and fully trying to, I'm not trying to understand, but just by hearing it, I'm like, I know how that works. And yeah, and I wish I could turn that part of my brain off, because yeah. it takes away some of the enjoyment, I think. I wish I could have the sort of non-songwriter's experience in listening to music sometimes.
So, when this lockdown business subsides and a new normality resumes, what you got coming up? What's day to day going to be for Jamie?
Yeah, thank you. So I took a job as a songwriter a year or so ago, and I'm working for a company called Various Artist Management, run by a guy called Dave Bianchi, and there's a lot of cool artists on the management company. Tom Grennan's on there, Ash Nico's on there, he looks after the Libertines, Spiritualized, Supergrass, and there's tons of really cool artists that are on the same management company, and I've been working for them for a year as a songwriter. I've written songs with a lot of the artists that are there, and I've got some songs coming out soon, but my main thing that I've been doing for the company is working for this guy called Daniel Briskin. He's an 18-year-old guy that I worked with between March and September, and we made a record together that was then picked up by Virgin Records, and it's amazingly he's been picked up by the same team, a guy called Ben Palmer, who is one of the heads of Virgin over there underneath Ted Cockles, who has picked up Daniel Briskin and has signed him to Virgin. And the first record that we've made together is due to come out at some point in the near, not too distant future. I can't like give an exact date, but that record that we made between March and September, we went down to Margate to make at the Libertine studio down in Margate in February, just before lockdown. And we finished that record there, and that's due to come out in the not too distant future. So that's really exciting to know that we're still going to run with that even during lockdown.
Yeah.
And then as soon as things start easing up a bit, Daniel and I, since signing to Virgin, they plugged us into other songwriters in the country, in London and around. We did a bit of traveling, and we wrote another huge batch of songs together. That a potential second project for Daniel, and as soon as we can sort of ease up a bit on the social distancing, then we're going to go into the studio and finish up the second project for him, which I'm very excited about. You know, I got off a phone call to the record company before talking to you this morning, and everyone's really excited about him. So yeah, he's my main thing, my main artist that I work with, and I love him to bits. He's 18 years old, and he's a phenomenal talent, and we're very, very excited to sort of give that to the world.
Is there anything on Spotify currently from him?
There is something you can check out at the moment, but I think that we'll see. I think it's worth waiting a minute and seeing what it is we've been working on. And the kid is just phenomenal. I listened to it. I got the masters through last week, and I listened to it in the studio loud, and I cried after listening to it. The kid, he's just phenomenal.
Wow.
And that's my main thing. I've been working on some other bits and bobs, nothing that I want to shout about as yet, because I'm being secretive. And I'm writing songs, you know, and I'm back at work, and I'm looking forward to being able to hang out with people again. And it's going to be a funny one to navigate, where when people can, you know, because for me going to work, if I was writing a song with you, it would just be me and you in a room.
Yeah,
you know, it's a funny one to navigate, isn't it? Because in many ways, if I was working for a bigger company, we would go and do that. And,
sure.
And so, yeah, I mean, the future is waiting to figure out when everybody's comfortable and sort of allowed to go back into a studio together. And I'm gonna crack on writing songs and looking forward to getting into the next phase of my songwriting decision. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, best of luck with that. And thank you so much for giving up your time today, Jamie. I've absolutely loved chatting to you.
Yeah, me too, mate. Thank you very much for letting me be honest. I've told you lots of stuff that I didn't think would ever come out of my mouth. It's been great.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, mate.
All right, mate. Great. Good stuff. Thank you.
There you go. Oh, what a great chat. I'd never met, as I've touched on at the beginning, I'd never met Jamie before, and what a smashing dude. It was a really lovely chat, and I look forward to, like everyone else, to this pandemic being done and dusted and normality to resume, and I look forward to catching up with Jamie and having a nice cup of tea, because he was an absolute cracker of a guest. As I said at the beginning, if you can subscribe, that really does help this podcast. And if you want to help even more, aside from listening and having a route around in the archives, then I do have a Patreon page, and you can get access to loads of other episodes over there and support the podcast. You can find out about everything at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. That's me done. I'm back next week with another episode. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe and see you soon. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing, www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out, because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with Code Program for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code Program.